Welcome back. It's the third hour of Issues Etc. today. In the next hour, we're going to be discussing several issues with our good friend and regular guest, Wesley Smith, attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. We will be talking a little bit about the Raelians. Now, the angle that Wesley might take on this is not going to be on the UFO angle so much as the cloning angle. And of course, the story there is that the Raelians, through one of their subsidiary corporations called CloneAid, this UFO cult, claimed about 2 weeks ago that they had cloned the first human baby. Not very long after that, they claimed there was another cloned human baby that they were taking credit for. As far as I know, they have yet to produce any kind of evidence for the fact that these babies, assuming they do exist, and I think babies exist, these babies are in fact exact genetic duplicates of the donor of the DNA. We'll wait and see what happens there. We'll also be talking about what your doctor tells you. If he's wrong, it might be too late for you by the time you discover it. We're going to start out talking about what seems to me kind of the truth stranger than fiction, if all this other stuff is not strange. A doctor in Australia is planning to build a new machine designed for one purpose: to kill people. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And he's doing it all in the name of mercy. Wesley Smith, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm very well. Tell us about this Australian doctor. We've heard about him before, in fact. I think you and I have had conversations about this guy.
Oh, yes. Dear Philip Nitsky, he's being paid by the United States Hemlock Society tens of thousands of dollars to develop suicide machines and what is known as the peaceful pill. That would be a suicide concoction made of common household ingredients. He has advocated on National Review Online, and if anybody wants to go see the interview, all they have to do is a search for Nitschke, N-I-T-S-C-H-K-E, and that not only should terminally ill people have access to this suicide facilitation, but so should bereaved senior citizens, depressed people, even troubled teenagers. In fact, he has said that this peaceful pill of his should be in supermarkets. Despite this, the Hemlock Society is pouring tens of thousands of dollars, actually because of it, into Nitsky's pockets to develop these devices, and also made him the big invited star at their San Diego National Convention last weekend, where he, rousing applause, talked about rational suicide.
All right. The story is that he had built a prototype of this device, not the peaceful pill, but the euthanasia machine, as he would probably call it, but it has been seized by Australian authorities. Do you know anything about this?
Oh, yes. In fact, I sort of had something indirectly to do with that, actually. When I was in Australia in 2001 of August, I was brought down there to basically bust Nitsky's chops on this issue of assisted suicide for troubled teens. And I also went down there and exposed in the media that Canadian Right to Die societies were sending suicide plastic bags called the exit bag into Australia. Well, that made the national newspaper, and I was then contacted by Australia's Customs Department, and to show them what I had, which was instructions on how to commit suicide in this bag that they create for that purpose. And they made copies of the instructions, and then I came home. And apparently what happened was they prevented the Canadians from shipping those bags to Australia after that, and I had certainly nothing to do with this. A law was passed recently saying that if you have a suicide device in Australia, you cannot export it. And under that law, his suicide devices that he was bringing to the U.S. to demonstrate, not on a human being, but to show off, was seized. Now, an interesting question is, if he is developing these suicide apparatus, I don't know what the plural of apparatus is. Is it apparati?
Probably.
How is he testing it? Is he killing animals to test it? How do you know if it works? He claims that this new suicide machine, which creates, you put the like those oxygen things, tubes in your nose, and you have a little device that apparently creates carbon monoxide, kills very quickly. Well, how does he know unless he's either tested it on people or tested it on animals? And I think that's something that I would like to see the media ask. I was on a CNN interview, CNN International, about this the other day. Not only was the interview of Mitski fawning, but they didn't ask him, for example, that basic question. How do you know it works? What have you tested on? Have you killed bunnies? Have you killed dogs? This is a man who, when he was 15, cut a dog's throat because he didn't like it barking. So this is Miss Dr. Compassion, and he is basically the Australian Kevorkian.
Now, where, if he has left his native country of Australia, where is he planning to build the device?
No, he still lives in Australia. He lives in the North Territory.
Okay.
And he just was not allowed to take the device out of the country that he had already built.
All right. Then, I guess, as to your earlier point, are there regulations then in Australia, to your knowledge, but maybe to our own context here in America, that would regulate, this would certainly at least be sold as a medical device, that medical devices in their research, their development, their invention, not involve harm to human beings, that that medical devices at least be tested to meet some sort of basic regulatory scrutiny?
It's an astonishing question, isn't it? Think about what you're asking. Should the government regulate suicide machines? I mean, good grief. And I'm not putting you down or anything.
I know.
Think about where we've come as a society. I think that the FDA would probably have jurisdiction over such a thing, because if you have a device that may harm somebody in medicine, you're supposed to get FDA approval, and I don't know of any legitimate researcher in this country that is researching assisted suicide devices. In Oregon, they give people massive overdoses of barbiturates, like 90 pills to take. And what is amazing to me is that is deemed legitimate, even though those pills, barbiturates, were not created for the purpose of killing. And when John Ashcroft tried to state that based on federal law and using federally controlled substances, killing is not a legitimate medical purpose, you had a federal court saying, well, you can't regulate federal law because the state of Oregon has said that these federally controlled substances can be used to kill, which endangers the entire Controlled Substances Act and the entire fight against drug abuse. I mean, this whole thing gets completely thrown off into a Salvador Dali painting in order to justify killing. But no, I don't know of any attempts to create suicide devices governed by the FDA. Now, Derek Humphrey, the founder of the Hemlock Society, has how to commit suicide videos. He suggests using a plastic bag and helium as one example. And he has a company called NuTech, NuTech, for creating things like the debreather. Do you see how weird this is? The debreather, which takes oxygen out of your breathing instead of putting it in. But I have not known of any attempt to get FDA approval. I would like to see the FDA kind of come down on that. But it's hard to do politically, because you end up with federal court saying, I'm sorry, federal government, you can't do that.
Let's say, for hypothetically, that Nitski had made it out of Australia with the suicide machine, come to San Diego as he intended to do, to the Hemlock Society meeting. Would he have been violating any U.S. laws by bringing this device and saying, here's the device, here are my blueprints, let's build more?
I don't know. That's the honest answer. That's never been tested. It's certainly worth considering. But, you know, until very recently, nobody ever considered that people would be importing suicide machines. And can you imagine suicide machines? What we need are, when people are suicidal, is to help them get through that darkness. If they need better medical care, give it to them. If they need psychiatric involvement, let's get them that kind of help. But suicide machines? We're importing or exporting suicide machines? It is quite bizarre.
Now, Nitski can't be the only person thinking about this. Are you concerned that there is some bright, misguided soul here in the United States who fancies himself the American counterpart of Nitski, who is working on his own machine as well?
Oh, sure. Jack Kevorkian was the first one. His suicide machine was, he had a couple of them. One dealt with, you pull a lever and you get a lethal injection. Another one was just a matter of hooking up a carbon monoxide canister to a oxygen mask. So Kevorkian's already been involved in that. And as I said, Derek Humphrey has his little corporation, NuTech, to try to invent these devices. At some point, it may be that authorities will have to intervene. And right now, the Hemlock Society has a group they call the Caring Friends that, it is my understanding, go out and help people learn how to use these devices to kill themselves.
It says at the end of the Associated Press article that I have in front of me, the new machine allows operation without assistance, circumventing laws against assisted suicide. That's what Nitzke actually said. There's been so much...
If I put a cock gun in somebody's hand and tell them how to pull the trigger, if I assisted a suicide, I don't know the answer to that question. But remember, what this man is after is death on demand. It's not compassion. There was a woman named Nancy Crick in Australia who went to the media with Nitzke's help. Nitzke was involved supposedly as her physician. And she supposedly had terminal cancer, and it was a huge media feeding frenzy, as we've seen, like with the Raelians down in Australia, about her assisted suicide out of compassion because she had terminal cancer. Well, she kills herself in front of about 24 assisted suicide advocates who, when she swallowed the pills, applauded. Can you imagine? They're applauding this woman swallowing poison. And then she has an autopsy, and guess what? She didn't have terminal cancer. Her cancer had actually been cleared up through medical treatment. Nitzke then said, well, I knew that all along, but it doesn't matter. So, the whole assisted suicide movement is rife with disinformation and outright lies.
So this is not about assisted suicide. This is not about a compassionate death. This is about suicide and death, period.
To me, it is. It's the equivalent of seeing somebody on a hotel roof and yelling, jump, jump, jump.
Now, you talked about the cocked revolver. If I found someone who is suicidal and they were just looking for a revolver, I had one with me, loaded, if I cocked it and handed it to them, what would I be charged with in the U.S.?
I think you could be charged with assisted suicide. In fact, I think there was a case similar to that in which the person was.
And so it seems to me there's a real conflict in the realm of jurisprudence on this whole issue of assisting people with suicide, especially
through
these devices.
People are assisting, from my view, there haven't been any formal research studies, but it seems to me that there's an increase in the number of stories, and this is anecdotal, this is just as I'm looking at the paper and seeing the television news, there are increasing number of stories of people killing their disabled children, elderly husbands killing their sick wives, hospital personnel killing, the angel of death kind of situation that seem to be on the increase. And most of those people are being put in jail for that kind of assisted suicide or mercy killing. And I think that the tougher these sentences get, the better, because otherwise people are going to get the message, which they got from the Kevorkian fiasco, that killing people in the name of ending suffering is a legitimate thing to do when it isn't.
You were in Australia during 2001. What was your sense of kind of the public mood with regard to this issue, especially swirling around Nitzke himself?
Well, I was appalled at the media, I must say, because I saw in the Australian media the same phenomenon you see in the you saw in the American media surrounding Kevorkian. It became a circus. He became almost a hero. You know, we live in an era of the moral outlaw. And it's very difficult. I call it terminal non-judgmentalism, because we have this. We seem to have this idea as a society that we don't have the right to draw moral lines in the sand beyond which we will not accept certain conduct. And so what happened was, I went down there, and the people who brought me released this press release that I was coming. There was a media frenzy. At first, Nitzke admitted it. Then he denied it. Even though the day before he was in the Sydney Morning Herald saying yes, on Tuesday and Wednesday he started saying no, and the media said, well, he's rebutted you, hasn't he? I said, no, he's lied. Look what he said in the National Review Online, and look what he said in the Sydney Morning Herald. Then they changed the subject. Then when I was on CNN International the other day with him, off the air, you should have seen the fawning. Oh, thank you, Dr. Nitzke, for appearing. We appreciate it so very, very much. We're so very, very grateful. Good grief. I wanted to throw up. It was incredible.
Not very encouraging, Wesley.
No, and it's like the same thing that happened with the Raelians. Here was a story where these flying saucer cult fanatics who claim that all life on this planet came about as a result of alien beings coming down to this barren earth and cloning us into existence, who believe that cloning is the answer to human immortality, that we will be able to make clones of ourselves and download our minds and our consciousnesses into these these new clone beings that are ourselves, saying that they've cloned a human baby. No proof, nothing. And the media spent a week going hog wild. And when Rael went on the Connie Chung show, right, on CNN, he said, "You must call me Your Holiness." And she did it. She called him Your Holiness. I mean, it's humiliating to, it would seem to me, to a legitimate journalist. Connie Chung should be laughed out of the core, because in order to get Rael on the show, she's willing to call him Your Holiness. It's astonishing to me.
What do you make of the former ABC science correspondent, now kind of an independent science journalist? And I don't know his name. It's not really pertinent here. But what do you make of him stepping forward and saying, "Look, I've been following this Raelian story for a long time. I'd like to convene the independent group of people, scientists, researchers, whatnot, who can verify or put to the lie the Raelian's claim."
Well, you know, that's another aspect of how ludicrous this was. He was the selection of the Raelians because he was pals with them, and he'd been, you know, hanging around and trying to sell the story of human cloning to various media. I mean, if you're going to have an independent verification, it's almost like allowing Saddam Hussein to pick the UN weapons inspectors, right? You don't let Saddam Hussein pick the UN weapons inspectors, and you don't let the Raelians pick the people to lead the research to see if this clone is true. You let it be truly independent, which, of course, the Raelians wouldn't do because, of course, it was a huge hoax. But here's what's really disgusting and sickening about that whole thing. I debated Brigitte Bousier, the woman who you saw on television, at the University of Alabama. And she and a bunch of other Raelians, so there were at least 60 to 80 in a audience of about 300 to 350 people. She said one of the reasons to clone is so that you can recreate your dead child, which I think is a terrible travesty. It is a terrible abuse of vulnerable people who have lost their child. Remember how desperate Mary Todd Lincoln was when Willie Lincoln died? She got into seances. She was so desperate to have some connection with her dead boy. So the Raelians are charging these desperate, grieving parents hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to clone their dead children as if you could bring those children back. But, of course, you can't bring those children back. And to even assume you could is to say in some way, and I'm not blaming the parents who are desperate, but that my child was not as so special after all. She can be recreated, but she can't be. And I, after that debate, I spoke with a grieving couple who had been brought there kind of as a sales pitch, right, who, thank goodness, had decided not to go forward. But they shared with me how desperate they were because they'd lost their little girl. And here the Raelians are charging $200,000 to $500,000, that's the numbers I've seen, to these desperate parents saying, "We can return your babies to you." And it's wrong. It's so awful. I really was nauseous at the very prospect.
You know, up until what you just said there, with that little bit of information, probably most of our listeners thought this Raelian story was just kind of an odd, quirky thing to chuckle about around the copy machine. It sounds like there's a sinister quality.
Oh, I think there's a real sinister quality, and they're going into Africa big time, and I think it's so they can have access to poor women, because in order to clone, you need to get access to a lot of human eggs, and we've talked about that on this show before. There are, human eggs are not an abundant commodity for these kinds of purposes. But there's also another problem here with the Raelians, and that has to do with this very announcement, and the reaction to it, I think, started a very important clock ticking. Even though this was a huge hoax, you already saw a lot of people saying, "Oh, well, you can't stop science. We've got to go forward with cloning. Otherwise, we're a bunch of Luddites and retrogrades and reactionaries." Richard Cohen, who is a very serious pundit for the Washington Post and has national exposure, said he wrote a piece in response to this saying he was tired of hearing about human dignity and tired of hearing about ethics. The time has come to go forward with cloning and no more delays. And I'm just, you know, and that was started by this hoax. So if you ever had any researchers who were legitimate in the fact that they actually had the capacity to do this, you know, it wouldn't take long unless we can get some laws outlawing this before people just shrug their shoulders the way they did to Kevorkian's assisted suicide campaign.
You have called because there is, at this point, a strong sense in the United States, and without legislation to back it up all the way through the Senate, but the House has passed a bill that would have banned all human cloning. There is a sense that human cloning for the purposes of reproduction is anathema, at least at this point. But you have called this kind of devil-may-care, let's be the bad boy against public opinion on reproductive cloning, a Kevorkian strategy. Why do you call it that?
Sure, because it's in your face. It's what the Raelians are doing. You're in your face, and you're unrepentant, and you start screaming that anybody who opposes you are just based on religious reaction, and this society will turn itself on its head and eventually support you if you stick with it long enough. That's what happened with Kevorkian. He ended up being the big celebrity at the Time 75th anniversary party, Time Magazine, where Tom Cruise went running up to shake his hand. It's amazing. The Raelians, you saw the same kind of thing, and that led to that Richard Cohen article I was talking about. A lot of bioethicists, which, as you know, I pay close attention to, are all in favor of reproductive cloning when it's safe to do. In other words, when you could do it without having genetic defects in the babies, because most mammals that are cloned today have terrible genetic defects. So there really is a whole cadre of people who really want to see this happen, but in order to get there, they want research cloning so you can learn how to clone. And that's what the fight in the Senate is about. Should you ban reproductive cloning only, or should you ban all human cloning? But let me tell your audience about a new law that is a new, I'm sorry, it's not law yet, legislation that just passed the New Jersey Senate. And I wrote about this in my weekly Standard piece, and I'm stunned that I even had a long talk with a reporter yesterday for a major metropolitan newspaper, which I won't name, who didn't seem to care about this. And what the New Jersey State Senate has passed has said that they will permit nuclear cell transfer cloning for research purposes in New Jersey. And the only thing that they outlaw is what they say is cloning a human being. And if you do that, you're guilty of a crime. But listen to how they define what the term cloning a human being.
We've got about a minute here, Wesley.
As used in this section, cloning of a human being means the replication of a human individual by cultivating a cell with genetic material through the egg, embryo, fetal, and newborn stages into a human individual. If that law passes as is, it would be legal in the state of New Jersey to clone an embryo, implant it in the woman, gestate it to the 9th month, and then require abortion. So that's where this stuff is heading. And only 2 years ago, we were saying all we need are the leftover IVF embryos for stem cell research. Now New Jersey has legislation that's passed its state senate that would permit cloning to the 9th month and then require abortion, because the only crime it would be to have that clone reach the newborn status.
Wesley, you willing to stay with us across the break here?
Sure.
All right. Thank you very much. Wesley Smith is our guest, attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. We're talking about, well, we had been talking about plans for an Australian doctor to make a euthanasia machine. We moved on to the issue of the Raelians. Got a few more questions. In fact, Wesley anticipated a question that was rolling around in my head, and that was, you know, how long will it be before a state decides to legalize cloning, just the way they legalized assisted suicide? Sounds like the answer is coming from New Jersey. When we come back, I'll tell you how you can read several of Wesley Smith's columns on his website.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
I want to lose weight in 2003. I'm going to get my finances under control this year. I want to spend more time with my family in the next 12 months. Here's an idea. How about learning more about the essential teachings of Christianity with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January, To All Eternity? The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section. That's issuesetc.org. To All Eternity contains fine works of art and stirring meditations that will help you embrace and understand the eternal truths of the Bible. To All Eternity, the essential teachings of Christianity. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040. That number again, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040.
It's a perfect world, but full of disease.
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the book Genesis and the Decay of the Nations. Well, Ken, how can there be such a thing as a perfect world, but with disease?
I went to my doctor for a checkup. He asked me what I did, so I explained how I speak on the creation evolution issue. Now, the doctor said he went to church, but with his training in science, he realized that scientists didn't have all the answers. And so with the book of Genesis, he just stands back and says he doesn't understand it. I then explained to him that fossil bones in the layers of rocks, that are supposedly millions of years old, show evidence of diseases like cancer. I said to him, when God stated that everything was very good, do you think the world was full of cancer? I then explained how death, bloodshed, disease, and suffering couldn't have existed before sin. So how could you believe in millions of years? As the doctor left the room, he turned and said to me, that bit about no disease and death before sin, I'm going to have to think about that. I haven't heard that before. That's very challenging. Christians should believe in the plain teaching of the Bible from its very first verse.
Ever since the Scopes trial in 1925, the Christian church has been largely unable to answer tough questions about the Bible. And one of those is, if there is a God, why do we see so much death, bloodshed, and disease in our world? Well, the answers are found in the Bible and posted on our radio website, answersradio.com. Ken Ham has written a free booklet entitled, Why Is There Death and Suffering? It's a free service at answersradio.com.
:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Weather for St. Louis, cloudy tonight, low near 22, light snow developing. For tomorrow, cloudy and breezy, total accumulation of snow right about 6 inches, high near 25 tomorrow. Right now, overcast and 28 in St. Louis. Taking a look at St. Louis traffic, westbound 40 is slow from east of Hampton to Hanley and 270 to Mason. Southbound 270 between Clayton Road and Big Bend, there's some slow traffic there. Westbound 44 at 270, slow traffic in the right lane. Eastbound 40 after Jefferson, heavy traffic to the Poplar Street Bridge. And northbound 55 between Park Avenue and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic in the right lane. That's traffic and weather on AM 850 KFUO. I'm Craig Allen. Up next, 30 more minutes with Wesley Smith right here on AM 850 KFUO.
Here he is, Pastor Jolly John Lukowski, to tell you all about his exotic trip to the French Riviera.
Well, actually, Paul, it was a Buick Riviera. Yeah, it was a little confusing. It was one of those internet deals, you know, and I guess I didn't read the fine print.
Well, he might not have that right, but when it comes to the Bible, he certainly does, and we invite you to listen to Wrestling with the Basics on AM 850 KFUO, 9:05 on Saturday mornings, Wrestling with the Basics on AM 850 KFUO. He's speechless.
Friday on Issues Etc. Well, we've talked a little bit about the Raelians here with Wesley Smith, and we will talk very briefly about them as well with Ken Samples Friday on the program, a two-hour discussion on UFOs and extraterrestrials. The book he has co-authored is called Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, and he does talk a little bit about UFO cults and the Raelians. Ken Samples of Reasons to Believe Friday on Issues Etc. Wesley Smith is our guest for the next 25 minutes. He is attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, and author of the book Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. Our phone numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And if you're interested in reading Wesley Smith's columns, not only are they available from time to time on National Review Online, but he has a website of his own, wesleyjsmith.com, wesleyjsmith.com. Wesley, before the break, you were telling us about this New Jersey Senate bill that was passed, S-1909, that you say would permit cloning of a human embryo all the way to 9 months and then require an abortion. And what would then happen after that?
Well, let me be clear how this does that. It does not in the law. This is all very sneaky. This is not in the law saying you can, you can implant and gestate to the 9th month and then you must abort. What it does is say you can engage in human cloning for purposes of research. It then says what you cannot do is clone a human being. It then defines a human being that goes all the way through to the newborn stage. So if you stop anywhere short of a newborn, because of the way the term human being is defined, you've not broken any law. So they basically legalize it by omission, not by specific statement. But if something is not against the law, that means it's legal.
And
right?
It seems that medical research is often in the business of testing the boundaries of these things.
And that's why we have the Nuremberg Code. I mean, we have to look at our relationship as a society to research, scientific research and medical research. We, of course, want a robust research community. We want to advance in terms of our abilities to reduce suffering and to heal ailments and to have better lives for the entire world. But science does not, it's not bioanarchy. That means scientists are part of society, and therefore society has the right to put certain restrictions on the scientific enterprise. As an example, the Animal Welfare Act tells scientists that there are certain things they cannot do in researching using animals because we don't want to cause animals unnecessary suffering, and that's important. That puts some constraints on scientists. There are some things that might be scientifically interesting to do, indeed, which might create some knowledge for us, but which we don't do because to do so would be to cause unnecessary and extreme suffering for animals. The Nuremberg Code came as a result of Nazis in the death camps treating Jews as research subjects in ways that were abhorrent. Now, from a purely scientific basis, you know, the scientific method has no morality. It's just a method of obtaining information. So from a purely scientific basis, some of those experiments might have obtained some interesting information. For example, how long does it take a human being to die of hypothermia when put in ice water? But it's morally abomination. So science has to be constrained by morality and ethics. And I can't imagine any legitimate science who would say that that isn't true. When we come to the issue of cloning, and it's moving so fast, society has not been able to actually catch up with whether or not we want to go forward with any of this, and if we do, the kinds of constraints to place on it. But we live in an era of moral anarchy and moral outlawry. So you have Stanford University, one of the great universities in the world, saying we're going to start cloning human embryos for purposes of research, and we hope others will too, along that same kind of Kevorkianism, right? We're just going to stick it in your face. Only they didn't have the courage of their convictions, and to a certain degree, because they tried to pretend that cloning for research isn't cloning. And they even lied about what the President's Council on Bioethics said, that a clone embryo used for research was, they said it was not a clone, Stanford said that, when in actuality the council had said unanimously that a clone created through nuclear cell transfer, even if used for research, is indeed a human clone. So they had to take that back. But this is the same kind of issue. We're going to do this, we're in your face, there's nothing you can do about it, and they wanted other universities to jump on so people would shrug their shoulders and say, oh, well, there's nothing we can do. But there's something we can do, there's something we have to do, and at the very least in this session of Congress we need to get a 4-year moratorium or so on all human cloning so we can catch our breath and see what's happening. I've also urged in writing that we outlaw putting animal DNA into human embryos. Now, that was on National Review Online just about 2 or 3 months ago, and I thought I was years ahead of the curve. In fact, I think I said in the article, you know, this is something that may not come up for years, but let's put this line down now so we can at least prove we can put some reasonable limits on this. And then what do I find out? The first human mouse chimera, part human, part mouse, has already been created. Now, it's mostly mouse, but it's got thousands of human brain cells in its brain. And there was a meeting about 3 weeks ago in New York of some of the really prominent researchers in this field to try to come up with a voluntary agreement not to mix animal and human DNA into human embryos, and they couldn't reach agreement. So I wasn't years ahead of the curve. I wasn't even ahead of the curve. We have to start putting down some markers that says, look, you can go into these areas. We want you to, for example, adult stem cell research. But there are certain places we're not going to allow you to go because it's bad for society. It's bad for individuals. It's bad for society. It's dehumanizing. And we will not allow us a legitimate scientist to go beyond this particular spot. And until we do that, and unless we do that, we will be in a state of bioanarchy. Now, the opponents of that say, well, the only Taliban Luddites, in fact, the science writer for the Washington Post said that people who oppose human cloning are the equivalent of Taliban. That shows you where his bias is. His name is Rick Wise. But if you take a look at the nations around the world, Australia has banned all human cloning. Australia is not a conservative country, to say the least. Canada, which is San Francisco as a country, is on the verge of banning all human cloning. France has banned all human cloning. Norway has banned all human cloning. Norway is not known as a Taliban country. Taiwan has banned all human cloning. We should be leading this struggle, not following it. President Bush wants to lead it. The House of Representatives wants to lead it. Senator Brownback, a pro-life Republican, and Mary Landrieu, a pro-choice Democrat from Louisiana, want to lead it, but people like Daschle and Senator Kennedy and Senator Clinton are throwing up a bunch of dust, and Senator Feinstein, my senator, that is preventing us from outlawing all human cloning or at least putting a moratorium on. And I'm hoping that that all your listeners will contact their representatives and say, listen, none of this phony partial ban on only reproductive cloning. We need a ban on all cloning so we can catch our breath and find out what we want to do here.
Wesley, you know, you mentioned the senators. How about giving Feinstein a run for her money, running for the Senate yourself?
Yeah.
Hey, you mentioned...
If you got about $10 million for me.
No, if I had $10 million, I know where I'd be using it.
Yeah.
I might share a little with you, but not that kind of money. You mentioned the Stanford University announcement, and Irving Weissman, the head researcher there, does he know better? He came out in the paper. He actually said that there's a difference between somatic nuclear cell transfer and cloning for reproduction, when in fact the two processes are precisely the same. It's just the term that the baby is allowed to live. Does he know better than this?
Of course he does. He just doesn't have the courage of his convictions, and he doesn't respect the American people enough to be thoroughly honest with them. Irving Weissman says that, look, cloning is done when you take a nucleus from like a skin cell and take out a nucleus from a human egg, put the nucleus from the skin cell in it, zap it with electricity, and if it starts to divide embryonically, that's the act of cloning. After that, there is no act of cloning. After that, it's what do you do with this cloned human embryo? If you implant it, you're trying to produce children. If you grow it and then destroy it and try to research on it, you're using it for research. But the cloning act is done. I call that the point of inception. It's the moral equivalent of the point of conception. It's done when you take this genetically altered egg and zap it with electricity, and it begins to divide like an embryo. And if you took an embryo that was created through fertilization under the microscope, and you took an embryo assuming you were successful through cloning under the microscope, you wouldn't be able to tell them apart. Of course he knows. And he also said something else that was dishonest. He's been put forward by the biotech community as somebody completely disinterested because he's an adult stem cell researcher, and he is not interested in doing embryonic research at all. Well, then suddenly he gets this head of this institute at Stanford that is designed to do embryonic research, and the very media that was touting how objective he was because he wasn't interested in embryonic research failed to mention that that was obviously not true, because that's what he's doing now. You know, the media has two approaches to this, it seems to me. One is you get people who really don't know the area, like a general reporter from a general pool reporter, and they can be snowed by these guys because they don't understand the technology, this isn't their beat, and so forth. Then you have people like Rick Wise of the Washington Post, who are very biased in favor of this research, and who then, of course, often skew their stories to benefit the research community and go against those who are opposed to it. But that's just like the force of gravity when you want to shoot a rocket to the moon. You just got to work with it and keep on trucking.
What is futile care theory?
Here's another area of concern. This is, to me, the first cousin of assisted suicide. Assisted suicide says that there are some lives that have such little dignity and value and are of such low quality that if they those people want to kill themselves, we'll help them do it. Feudal care theory says there are some lives that have such little dignity and low quality that even if they want medical treatment to sustain their life, we won't let them have it. It is basically stating that the hospital has the right to refuse service to people whose quality of life they deem to be not up to par or not worth spending the money on. And that wanted, I'm not talking about unwanted, I'm talking about wanted, life-sustaining treatment or other forms of medical treatment can be refused other than comfort care. And it is it's basically a game of doctor knows best. If we think your life is worth living, we'll sustain your life. If we don't, we won't. And that's incredibly dangerous. And these feudal care protocols are being swept into hospitals throughout the country, and we don't know who has them and who doesn't.
It seems to me, on reading your article, Doc Knows Best, it'll be too late for you if he's wrong on National Review Online, that there's a very fine line between feudal care theory and its practice, these protocols, and downright medical negligence.
Well, it seems to me that there's you've got a point there, and it also borders on abandonment. I mean, we were told, for example, when the best thing bioethics has done, I think, has made sure that if people do not want medical treatment, they can say no, right? So you don't have to have tubes stuck in you if you don't want tubes stuck in you. You don't have to have antibiotics. You don't have to have chemotherapy if you don't want it. And that's important because we have to respect people's autonomy. But now we're saying that if you do want some of these things and you need them to sustain your life, the doctors can play a whole new game of doctor knows best and say, no, your life isn't worth living, and we know what's better for you. And what's remarkable to me is in response perhaps to my article, but certainly after my article came out, which was prompted by an article in a Iowa newspaper talking about how hospitals in Des Moines have put these protocols in place, the Des Moines Register came out and said, well, the doctor should decide. I mean, I bet if you went through the Des Moines Register's editorials, you'll find editorial after editorial saying, we have the right to personal autonomy. Doctors should not force people to take medical treatment. Doctors should not force people in comas to have feeding tubes because these are private, intimate decisions that belong with the family. And now when the decision might be to have the feeding tube or have the medical treatment, the Des Moines Register is saying the patient should not decide, the doctor should. It's astonishing. I sometimes just want to pound my head into a brick wall because that's what I feel like I'm doing sometimes.
what role do health maintenance organizations have in this whole issue of
feeding
care policy?
Well, this is a real key here because what we're talking about in the end is money. The people who the doctors wish to refuse treatment for, or not all doctors, by the way, many doctors fight this agenda, but the bioethics community, and again, not every bioethicist is in favor of that, but there seems to be a consensus for it. The people they want to be able to stop receiving life-sustaining treatment happen to also be the most expensive to care for. That's not a coincidence. Back when money was made in the intensive care unit, and profits were made by the longer you were in the hospital, that's when doctors hooked people up to machines against their will, remember? And then suddenly the profit motives switch, and the economics of medicine is turned on its head, and suddenly we're talking about death with dignity, and then even if you don't want the right to die, you are given a duty to die in some cases. So the issue of money is a lot of this. Plus, a lot of bioethicists see this as the good first step towards healthcare rationing, which most bioethicists want.
You also make the point that individual litigation, the litigation of individual cases on a case-by-case basis, is, well, to coin the phrase connected here, futile. Why is that?
Well, it's not futile, but these feudal care protocols kind of hope it will be. And what I meant by the difficulty of litigation, let's say that my mother, God forbid, has a terrible stroke. And she's told me that in such a circumstance, if she's incapacitated, she still wishes to receive antibiotics and medical treatment. I tell the doctor to give her that treatment. The doctor says, look, your mother's never going to be cured. The time has come for her to die, which some doctors have said to people because they've called me and told me this. And we're not going to give her anything but pain control to make sure she's not suffering, and she cannot have a feeding tube, and we won't give her antibiotics, and we won't reduce her fever. And I say, well, then I'm going to sue you. Right now, when you tell the doctor that, quite often they will say, all right, we'll give you what you want. But what these protocols are designed to do is to allow the hospital bioethicists and attorneys who get paid $500 an hour to go to court and say, look, judge, the doctors and bioethicists have worked this out. This is the standard of care. Who are you, a judge and a lawyer, to tell doctors how to care for a patient? Moreover, even if that aspect doesn't work, these hospital lawyers, corporate lawyers, could litigate an individual into bankruptcy, because this is not the kind of a case that a lawyer is going to take for a family on a contingency. They're going to have to pay the lawyer by the hour, $200 or $300 an hour, and these corporate lawyers know how to drag things out, file motions, file appeals, and pretty soon you might have fees of tens of thousands of dollars, which you can't afford. So the litigation thing may not be practical, and the purpose of the protocols is to stack the deck against the family who wants their loved one treated in favor of the values of the bioethicists or the doctors who may want that patient not treated.
Wesley, you have mentioned several times here that there's no real way to know at this point what hospitals have put in place these feudal care theory protocols and are operating with these things and which ones aren't. On an individual basis, how would I know for myself or my family? How would I go about finding it out?
You'd have to ask the hospital, "What I want to see your end-of-life ethical protocols. If I decide that I want life-sustaining treatment and you don't want to give it to me, how is that effort dealt with?" And so forth and so on. Also, you could do a search of the literature, because it is written about in places like the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, but most average folk don't read those things. I read them because I have to stay on top of things. And I know from reading these journals that they are now in Des Moines. Well, that came about because of a regular newspaper. But they're in Detroit. They're in Houston, without question. They're in Philadelphia in the Mercy Systems there, because that was published in a Catholic medical journal. They are certainly in California. There was a study here that studied 26 hospitals. 24 of the 26 had these protocols in place, and all but 7 of the 24 gave the final decision to somebody other than the family, either an ethics committee or the chief of staff, things of that sort. So they are spreading, and when my article came out in National Review Online, I'm part of a bioethics listserv, and those folk got furious with me, claiming that I was overhyping the issue and being provocative in my language. But I think this calls for provocative language. We are talking about the right to informed consent and patient autonomy being taken away, not to keep you alive, but to make sure you don't stay alive.
This seems a no-win situation if you're challenging it, because if the ethics committee of the hospital developed the feudal care protocols, they are also the one who arbitrate whether or not you can have care under these protocols.
Right.
You're stung twice.
Right. Well, and it becomes a secret star chamber, because right now under most state laws, ethics committees are anonymous and you cannot obtain information about what went on in those proceedings. And that's fine when the ethics committee is a mediating body, helping people work things through, which I favor. But when you turn it into a quasi-judicial body that has the legal power to say yes or no to wanted treatment, at that point there's no due process. Moreover, I've represented a woman in front of one of these committees. I did it for free because she was in such a state of hysteria because they wanted to pull the feeding tube at an HMO away from her husband, who was dying of Alzheimer's disease, and she knew her husband would not want that feeding tube taken. And we met in front of this ethics committee, in front of this horseshoe-type table, and everybody on that table knew each other. They knew the doctor, who was furious that this woman was defying him. And I was able to say, if you try to remove this man's tube, I will sue. And it worked. And that committee was not a judicial committee type thing, a quasi-judicial decision maker. It was a mediating body. And what we were able to do eventually was mediate so that a different doctor took over this patient's care. And he lived for 2 years after that. And when he died, his wife contacted me and was so happy because he was able to live and die in the way his values dictated. But if you have everybody knowing each other, they're part of the institutional culture, they may know that their institution has money problems and you're talking about an expensive patient, there's no due process. You're not going to have a written record. There's no appeal. Where's the due process here?
Now, You mentioned before the HMOs and the fact that this is driven by money. Is part of the long-term solution to this kind of thing to rework the economics of our healthcare system, our medical system, to de-incentivize these kind of futile care protocols in hospitals?
You know, all I know is what we need to do is work through the difficulties we have in healthcare, holding on to the sanctity of life ethic. If we say that every human life has equal inherent moral worth, then we'll come out okay. There are times when I think people do make mistakes in trying to maintain people for too long. For example, they'll say give CPR whatever it takes, not knowing that CPR can break the patient's ribs. The answer to these decisions, and most people are of incredibly goodwill, doctors just need to be brutally frank in what a treatment actually may constitute and the kind of suffering that some treatments may call. And I'm not saying that patients should not listen to doctors' recommendations, but what I am saying is that when it is wanted treatment that is needed to sustain life and is not being refused because it doesn't work, but is being refused because it does or could work, then I think the final decision-making must be the patient's, because it is a value judgment, not a medical judgment. And if we start giving power back to the doctors to decide whether our lives are worth living or not, we're giving somebody power who is not trained to have that kind of power. Who gave a doctors don't have any moral superior ability to decide these kinds of issues. They can give you good medical judgments. They can tell you what the consequences might be to a patient of sustaining life over an extended period. And people may decide they don't want that, or they may decide they do want that. But it's up to the, if we're going to have informed consent, the doctor is to give recommendations, the doctor is to tell us the pros and cons of different options, and then we decide. And if that is now going to be taken away, then what we are taking away is what we fought for the last 20 years to obtain, and that is the right to informed consent.
Folks, when you get home tonight, be sure to check out Wesley Smith's website at wesleyjsmith.com. Wesleyjsmith.com. The articles that we discuss here on Issues Etc. with Wesley are available there for you to read at your leisure. Wesley Smith, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you. I look forward to talking to you again.
Wesley Smith is attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, and author of the book Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. Something that always bears watching, but you know what? You know what? There might be some hope in this, in the economics, because if money is driving this, maybe reworking that economic system might make it not worth the hospital's time. Maybe they might be interested in caring for you or your loved one a little more because it simply favors their bottom line. Sad to say, but that might be one solution to this. Tomorrow on the program, do Lutherans and Calvinists agree on the doctrine of justification? They agree on a few things, disagree on a lot. What about the doctrine of justification? Pastor Arnold Bomey of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Waseca, Minnesota will be there. Also, we'll be talking with Dr. Martin Nolan of the Concordia Historical Institute about gospel reductionism. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.